Soon there were other encounters, in which the prince began to distinguish himself and those without any assistance from me. Whenever he strode past the young girls with the gold of valour gleaming on his chest and the champion's ribbon knotted into his plait, they giggled and blushed and slanted their eyes in his direction. Once I entered his tent in haste with some important news for him, only to come up short, as I found my prince well mounted and oblivious to all but the tender young body and the pretty face beneath him. I withdrew silently, a little saddened that the age of his innocence was past. Of all these pleasures, none for me could compare with those precious hours that I was still able to spend with my mistress. In this, her 33rd year, she was in the very high summer of her beauty. Her allure was enhanced by her sophistication and her poise. She had become a queen indeed, and a woman without peer. All her people loved her, but none of them as much as I did. Not even Tunnus was able to surpass me in my devotion to her. It was my pride that she still needed me so much, and relied upon me and my judgment and my advice so trustingly, notwithstanding the other blessings that I had to adorn my existence. She would ever be the one great love of my life. I should have been contented and replete, but there is a restlessness in my nature that was exacerbated by this new wanderlust that had come to plague me. Whenever I paused from my labours at Pharaoh's tomb and looked up at them, the mountains beckoned me. I began to make short excursions into their lonely gorges, often alone, but sometimes with Huey or some other companion. Huey was with me when I first saw the herds of wild ibex high above us in the lofty crags of the mountain. They were of a species we had never seen before. They stood twice as tall as the wild goats that we knew from the Nile Valley, and some of the old billy goats carried such a mass of curling horn that they seemed as monstrous as some fabulous beast. It was Huey who carried reports of these huge ibex back to the Twin Rivers where the fleet lay at Quibui, and within the month Lord Tunnus arrived at the Valley of the King's Tomb with his bow over his shoulder and Prince Memnon at his side. The prince was fast becoming as ardent a huntsman as his father, and was every bit as eager for the chase. As for myself, I welcomed the chance to explore those fascinating highlands in such company. We had meant to venture only as far as the first line of peaks, but when we climbed to their crest, we were presented with a vista that was breathtaking. We saw other mountains against the sky that were shaped like flat-topped anvils and wear the tawny colour of lions. They dwarfed the peaks on which we stood and lured us onwards. The Nile climbed in concert with us, up through precipitous valleys and dark gorges that churned its waters to gleaming white. We could not always follow its course, but in places were forced to climb above it and follow giddy goat tracks across the face of a frowning mountain. Then, when we had been lured deep into its maw, the mountain loosed its full fury upon us. We were 100 men in our company, with 10 pack horses to carry our provisions. We were camped in the depths of one of these fathomless gorges, with the fresh trophies of Tunnus and Memnon's latest hunt laid out upon the rocky floor for our appraisal and admiration. These were two goat's heads, the largest we had seen in all our travels, so heavy in horn that it took two slaves to lift one of them. Suddenly, it began to rain. In our Egyptian valley it may rain once in 20 years. None of us had ever imagined anything even remotely like the rain that fell upon us now. First, dense black clouds roofed over the narrow strip of sky that showed between the cliffs that walled us in, so that we were plunged from sunny noon into deep twilight. A cold wind raced down the valley and chilled our bodies and our spirits. We huddled together in dismay. Then lightning lanced from the sombre belly of the clouds and shattered the rocks around us, filling the air with the smell of sulphur and sparks struck from flint. Thunder burst upon us, magnified as it rolled from cliff to cliff, and the earth jumped and trembled beneath our feet. Then the rain fell. It did not come down upon us in the form of drops. It was as though we stood under one of the cataracts of the Nile when the river was in full flood. There was no longer air to breathe. Water filled our mouths and our nostrils so that we felt that we were drowning. The rain was so thick that we could see only the blurred outline of the man who stood an arm's length away. It battered us so that we were thrown down and cringed beneath the nearest rock for shelter. Still, it assaulted all the senses and stung our exposed skin like a swarm of angry hornets. It was cold. I had never known such cold, and we were covered only with our thin linen shawls. The cold sucked the force out of my limbs, and we shivered until our teeth clattered together in our mouths, and we could not still them even though we bit down with all the strength of our jaws. Then, above the sound of the falling rain, I heard a new sound. It was the sound of water which had become a ravening monster. Down the narrow valley where we lay swept a wall of grey water. It stretched from cliff to cliff and carried everything before it. I was caught up in it and tumbled end over end. I felt life being beaten out of me as I was thrown against the rocks. An icy water filled my throat. Darkness overwhelmed me, and I thought that I was dead. I have a vague recollection of hands dragging me from the flood, and then I was wafted away to some dark and distant shore. The voice of my prince called me back. Before I could open my eyes, I smelled wood smoke and felt the warmth of the flames on one side of my body. "Tata, wake up, speak to me!" The voice was insistent, and I opened my eyes. Memnon's face floated before me, and he smiled at me. Then he called over his shoulder. "He is awake, Lord Tanis." I found that we were in a rock cave, and that outside the night had fallen. Tanis came across from the smoky fire of damp wood and squatted beside the prince. "How are you, old friend? I don't think you've got any broken bones." I struggled into a sitting position and gingerly tested every part of my body before I replied. "Oh, my head is cracked through and every limb aches. Apart from that, I am cold and hungry." "Ha! You'll live then," Tanis chuckled, "though a while ago I doubted any of us would. We have to get out of these cursed mountains before something worse happens. It was madness ever to venture into a place where the rivers come out of the sky." "What about the others?" I asked. Tanis shook his head. "They are all drowned. You were the only one that we were able to drag from the flood." "What about the horses?" "Gone," he grunted. "All gone." "Food?" "Nothing," Tanis replied. "Even my bow is lost in the river. I have only the sword at my side and the clothes on my body." At dawn we left our rock shelter and started back down that treacherous valley. At the foot of the gorge we found the bodies of some of our men and the horses strewn upon the rocks where they had been stranded when the flood receded. We scavenged amongst the rocks and scree, and we managed to recover some of our stores and equipment. To my great joy I found my medicine chest still intact, though flooded with water. I laid out the contents on a rock, and while they dried I fashioned a sling from a leather harness to carry the chest upon my back. In the meantime, Memnon had cut strips of meat from the carcass of one of the horses and grilled them over another fire of driftwood. When we had eaten our fill, we saved the rest of the meat and set out on the return. The journey slowly descended into nightmare as we scaled steep rocky slopes and dropped into the gorges beyond. There seemed to be no end to this terrible wilderness, and our bruised feet in open sandals protested each step. At night, we shivered miserably around a smoky little fire of driftwood. By the second day, we all knew that we had lost the way, and that we were wandering aimlessly. I was certain that we were doomed to die in these terrible mountains. Then we heard the river, and as we topped the next saddle between peaks, we found the infant Nile winding through the depths of the gorge below us. That was not all. On the banks of the river we saw a collection of coloured tents, and amongst them moved the shapes of men. "Civilised men," I said immediately, "for those tents must be of woven cloth." "And those are horses," Memnon agreed eagerly, pointing out the animals tethered on the lines beyond the encampment. "There," Tanis pointed. "That was the flash of sunlight off a sword blade or a spearhead. They are metal workers." "We must find out who these people are." I was fascinated by what tribe could live in such an inhospitable land. "We will get our throats cut," Tanis growled. "What makes you believe these mountaineers are not as savage as the land in which they live?" Only later would we come to know these people as Ethiopians. "Those are magnificent horses," Memnon whispered. Our own are not so tall or so sturdy. We must go down and study them. The prince was a horseman above all else. Lord Thanos is right. His warning had aroused my usual prudent nature, and I was ready to counsel caution. These might be dangerous savages, with but the trappings of civilized men. We sat upon the shoulder of the mountain and debated for a while longer, but in the end curiosity got the better of all three of us, and we crept down through one of the ravines to spy upon these strangers. As we drew closer, we saw that they were tall, well-built people, probably more robust in stature than we Egyptians are. Their hair was thick and dark and curled profusely. The men were bearded, and we are all clean-shaven. They wore full-length robes, probably woven of wool, and brightly coloured. We go bare-chested, and our kilts are usually pure white in colour. They wore soft leather boots, as opposed to our sandals, and a bright cloth wound around their heads. The women we saw working amongst the tents were unveiled and cheerful. They sang and called to each other in a language I had never heard before, but their voices were melodious as they drew water, or squatted over the cooking fires, or ground corn on the millstones. One group of men was playing a board game that, from where I hid, looked very much like Beo. They were wagering and arguing over the play of the stones. At one stage, two of them leapt to their feet and drew curved daggers from their belts. They confronted each other, snarling and hissing like a pair of angry tomcats. At that stage, a third man, who had been sitting alone, rose to his feet and stretched like a lazy leopard. He sauntered across and, with his sword, knocked up the daggers. Immediately the two protagonists subsided and slunk away. The peacemaker was clearly the chief of the party. He was a tall man with the wiry frame of a mountain goat. He was goat-like in other ways, too. His beard was as long and thick as that of an ibex ram, and his features were coarse and goaty. He had a heavy hooked nose and a wide mouth with a cruel slant to it. I thought that he probably stank like one of the old rams that Thanos had shot from the cliff face. Suddenly I felt Thanos grip my arm, and he whispered in my ear, "Look at that!" This chieftain wore the richest apparel of any of them. His robe was striped in scarlet and blue, and his earrings were stones that glowed like the full moon. But I could not see what had excited Thanos. "His sword," Thanos hissed. "Look at his sword." I studied it for the first time. It was longer than one of our weapons, and the pommel was obviously of pure gold filigree work, of a delicacy that I had never seen before. The handguard was studded with precious stones. It was a masterpiece that clearly had occupied some master craftsman his lifetime. This was not what had captured Thanos' attention, however. It was the blade. As long as the chief's own arm, it was made of a metal that was neither yellow bronze nor red copper. In colour it was a strange silvery glittering blue, like the living scales of a Nile perch taken fresh from the river. It was inlaid with gold, as if to highlight its unique value. "What is it?" Thanos breathed. "What metal is that?" "I do not know." The chief resumed his seat in front of his tent, but now he laid the sword across his lap, and with a phallus-shaped piece of volcanic rock, began lovingly to stroke the edge of the blade. The metal emitted a ringing thrill of sound to each touch of the stone. No bronze ever resounded like that. It was the purr of a resting lion. "I want it," Thanos whispered. "I will never rest until I have that sword." I gave him a startled glance, for I had never heard such a tone in his voice. I saw that he meant what he said. He was a man struck with a sudden overpowering passion. "We cannot remain here longer," I told him softly. "We will be discovered." I took his arm, but he resisted. He was staring at the weapon. "Let us go to look at their horses," I insisted, and at last he allowed me to draw him away. I led Memnon by the other hand. At a safe distance we circled the camp and crept back towards the horse lines. When I saw the horses close up, I was struck with a passion as fierce as Thanos had conceived for the blue sword. These were a different breed from our Hyksos horses. They were taller and more elegantly proportioned. Their heads were noble and their nostrils wider. I knew those nostrils were the mark of stamina and good wind. Their eyes were situated further forward in the skull and were more prominent than those of our animals. There were great soft eyes, shining with intelligence. "They are beautiful," whispered Memnon at my side. "Look at the way they hold their heads and arch their necks." Tanos longed for the sword. We coveted the horses with a passion that equaled his. "Just one stallion like that to put to our mares," I pleaded to any god who was listening. "I would exchange my hope of eternal life for a single one."